Hello, everyone, and welcome to the American Immigration Lawyers Association's podcast entitled The Procedures, Risks, and Costs of Federal Court Litigation. I'm Becca Miller, AILA's Education Assistant, and it's now my pleasure to introduce today's panel. The discussion leader for this podcast is Melissa Crow, the Legal Director at the American Immigration Council in Washington, D.C. Joining Melissa are Matthew Hoppeck, who is on the AILA Federal Court Litigation Section Steering Committee of Overland Park, Kansas, and Paul Grotus of New York, New York. And at this time, I'd like to turn the podcast over to Melissa.
Thank you, Becca. In recent months, we've seen a lot of creative lawyering and a virtual blizzard of litigation, which has become an increasingly important tool to curb the excesses of the executive branch. We realize that federal court litigation can seem intimidating, both because of the substance of the underlying law and the procedural complexities. So the purpose of today's podcast is to demystify the litigation process by providing basic information about three of the most common types of claims: habeas, Administrative Procedure Act claims, and mandamus, along with relevant filing procedures. For more information after today's podcast, I encourage you to take a look at the American Immigration Council's practice advisories, which are easily accessible and completely free on our website, www.americanimmigrationcouncil.org, and they include practice assistance on the topics we'll be discussing today, as well as many others. So before we dive in, I'd like to start by asking my co-panelists what factors they consider in assessing whether litigation is in the best interests of your clients. Paul, can you start?
Sure. There's whenever I want to take a case to federal court, it usually means that I've really exhausted every remedy that I can think of prior to going to federal court. I would hate to bring a case to federal court and then have just be able to turn around and there have been a much quicker or easier solution. Generally, a file prior to going to federal court is a very large file. With the habeases, I often have tried to get bond in front of an immigration judge, and it's already been turned down. And with some of the cases that we'll talk about or some of the cases that the practice advisories cover, you may not need to do that. But I think it's a really good practice when you're starting out and you're looking to learn how to do these things to bring your claims to an immigration judge first, or in the mandamus context, to have made an info pass to try and get the situation resolved prior to doing so. Additionally, I always like to go over the case of the client in extraordinary detail before going to federal court, because when you're weighing the benefits and the risks, federal court is, in lack of a better word, no joke. It's a very serious place, and everything you file will be read and it will be scrutinized. And I'm not saying this to scare anybody. I'm just saying that you need to ensure that the facts that you're going to be representing are the truth, are actually the facts that your client is, basically the truth is the truth, that the information your client is telling you is the truth. And it's very easy to do if you're working on the case from day one, but it's a little bit more difficult to do if you're just being handed a file and being asked to go to federal court, because federal court there's a lot of remedies that are available to you there, but also it's a very, very serious place to practice law. And I think those are the things that I really think about.
Thanks. What about you, Matthew?
Yeah, so in the APA context, a lot of times we go there because of strategy, not so much because it's our last and final place. Sometimes we'd rather be in federal court than before one of the administrative appellate bodies. I typically try to talk with clients and make sure clients completely understand the timing of possible litigation and what that would look like as compared to an administrative appeal, the costs, how much it's going to cost us to file it, and what the costs might be over time depending on certain outcomes. What it's possible, what is it that we can get from federal court, and what is it that we know we can't get just from going to federal court. And then two other things that are really sort of unique to immigration litigation that we want to talk with every client about before we go to federal court. One of them is the public nature of filing a lawsuit against the government. I don't think the government retaliates against you for suing them but you may have a published decision with your name on it. And if you own a business and your competitors find out about it, or you know, those are things you certainly want to know before you file a lawsuit, and things not every client will know that this is a public, you know, everybody can access PACER if they want to and find out your business. And then the last thing I try to consider, especially in the mandamus context, is making sure the client understands and has clear expectations of what's going to happen in the suit. For example, what happens if we settle this before I file this lawsuit? You've hired me to file mandamus. My first step is always to try to negotiate with USCIS, and I have had clients angry at me that we didn't sue. You won this before we went to court. You promised we were going to court, so you didn't do what you said you were going to do. Well, we got your application approved. We just didn't have to go to court. Those are expectations that we can mold before we actually get to federal court and make sure the client knows you're not just paying me to file this lawsuit against the government. You're paying us to fix a problem.
Thank you. And I would just add, before we dive into the details of the different categories of cases that we're going to discuss today, that if people are interested in filing federal court challenges to denial of business-related petitions, we have at the American Immigration Council a business litigation attorney. Her name is Leslie Dellen, and she is available to help people, including first-timers, walk through this process and in some cases to co-counsel, depending on the issue involved. So please reach out to her if that is of interest.
So, there's one more thing that when Matthew was talking, kind of, it just happened to me. Another attorney filed an application which was pending for a very long period of time, and the family hired me to do a mandamus, and the mandamus prompted USCIS to adjudicate the application, but it prompted USCIS to deny the application. So I think in retrospect, I would have been a lot better suited to prompt and tell the family that, look, we're going to get a decision. It might not be the decision that you want. Just because you file a mandamus doesn't mean your application will get approved. It just means it'll get decided.
Thanks. Yeah, I think we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves, but let's ask people to keep that in mind, and we'll go into the elements of mandamus in just a few minutes. So let's start with habeas. Immediately after President Trump signed his first travel ban in the form of an executive order, Customs and Border Protection began detaining individuals from the affected countries at international airports across the United States. And just a few hours later, a coalition of civil and immigrants rights groups filed a class action habeas petition against the president and various immigration officials in the Eastern District of New York. Paul, can you tell us why these groups filed a habeas petition in this context? And then under what other circumstances might such a petition also be appropriate?
Sure. So the habeas petition is really the best way to sort of wave your arms in the air and say there's an emergency going on. I have a person who is in jail, or I have a person who may be deported immediately, and I need a judge to review this right now. And that's really why the habeas petition was filed, because throughout history, it's been utilized by attorneys to provide courts with an avenue to review somebody's detention. And I think that's the appropriate legal action. If you have a client who is actually being detained or with the threat of removal, the way to either stop their being removed immediately or to get them out of jail is through the habeas.
So those people at the airports, though, weren't technically detained. I mean, they weren't behind bars or anything. And so why did they use a habeas there?
They weren't technically behind bars, but you can only be held at an airport for a very, very brief period of time, and then you are actually transferred to a jail. The habeas is the proper methodology for dealing with someone who is detained, and technically you can file a habeas if there is some restraint on movement. So the actual legal threshold, for example, is if someone is on probation, they would make an argument through a habeas in a federal court. Even though they're not physically in jail, their freedom is being limited. Their movement is being limited. And so that's why it's the proper legal mechanism to do so.
So what are the basic elements of a habeas petition? What do you have to allege when you're filing a habeas?
Sure. Who? There's basically the who, what, when, why, and where. The who is your client. The other who is the person who is detaining your client, or who is the person who's restricting your client's movements. And you basically, when you're saying in the respondent's category, you want to throw in the kitchen sink. You want to name everybody. The Department of Homeland Security, the Attorney General. And I wrote a blog post, and I'm sure the practice advisory goes through this in a lot greater detail. But you basically want to include everybody as the properly named respondent. I can talk for a few hours about who is the proper respondent, but I think that's not really within the scope of this podcast. Basically, you want to name everybody as the proper respondent so that you would avoid a motion to dismiss saying that you haven't named the proper respondent. I mean, you're doing all this great legal work and you're trying to help people, but if you don't name the proper respondent, technically the court doesn't have jurisdiction. And obviously the petitioner would be your client. In the caption, it'll be petitioner versus respondent. And then you want to go into the court where your client is located. The proper venue follows your client. So if your client, for example, is in a car and the car is being moved from New York to New Jersey, while they're in New York, you can file in New York. While they're in New Jersey, you could file in New Jersey. The jurisdiction follows your client around. You can try and file in a jurisdiction where your client has ties, if the case law is better there or you feel there's some specific advantage to that, but the case might be tossed for lack of jurisdiction. The rest of the information that's in a habeas, the best way to learn how to do it is by looking at one of the sample habeases that AILA provides. It'll explain why should this court intervene on your client's behalf. For example, if you were to write a judge's decision, what information would you want in that decision granting your case? Why do you believe that your client should not be deported, and why do you believe that your client should be released from jail? Within there should be the legal argument, and the legal arguments that you can make are a little bit beyond this podcast, but they're pretty much covered. They're covered in the practice advisory, so I can go into them a little bit, but I think right now we're just trying to get into the nuts and bolts of how you do an actual habeas and what things you should know before doing one so that you're prepared should that emergency arise.
Absolutely. I just have one question for you, which is that, as we all know, people often get transferred from one detention facility to another at the whim of ICE. So what happens if your client is detained, let's say, in Boston, and you filed a habeas petition in a federal court there, and then after you file, the client gets moved to Texas, say?
It happens all the time. There's a couple of different things that you can do. The safest thing to do is after you file your habeas, where your client's located, you can do an order to show cause, and you could ask the judge to order DHS not to transfer your client outside of the court's jurisdiction while the habeas is pending. It's the easiest way to do it, because the other way is that you don't file an order to show cause. Your client is transferred to Texas, and now you have to go in front of the federal court judge and ask them to order DHS to move your client back within the court's jurisdiction. Now, in previous years, the ICE officers that I dealt with wouldn't transfer my client out of the court's jurisdiction because I had filed a habeas. However, now they are starting to do that more. So the best way to solve that problem and to not have a phone call from your client's family saying why is he being moved is to file an order to show cause after you file your initiating paperwork.
Thank you. Before we move on, do you have any other practice pointers that you want to offer our listeners today?
The main and the best practice pointers that I would offer is to call either the help desk or call the federal court where you're going to file. Because in federal court, every federal court that I have filed a habeas in, they require what's called a civil cover sheet, which is basically like a two-page document where you explain, where you check off boxes about what's going on in your court. And if you don't file this and you don't observe the proper procedure, you may get in trouble. Federal court, the rules are sacrosanct. And it's very important and imperative for you, and I think Matthew will agree when he does the the mandamus portion is you must follow all the rules in federal court.
Thanks. So many of the travel ban challenges also included claims under the Administrative Procedure Act. Matthew, under what circumstances do you, in the course of your own practice, file claims under the APA?
So we go to the APA when we have a final agency decision that we want to challenge. I think of it sort of like an appeal, but when the administrative appeal options are either limited or aren't going to be good enough. So the APA requires that you have a final agency action that is arbitrary and capricious, we know that standard, or is unconstitutional, or is outside the agency's statutory authority. So I typically sit down with a client and talk to them about what your options are. You've just gotten a denial on your I-140, for example. You could take this to the AAO. Here's their current processing times. Here's what you can expect from the AAO if you file an appeal and it gets remanded. And here's another option, which is federal court. The stuff we want to talk about is timing. What is it going to look like if we go to federal court? How quickly could we get a decision? A lot of our APA cases, we try to take strong cases to federal court under the APA, and in a lot of cases, a U.S. attorney gets to look at this for the first time. Sometimes I want to be sitting across from a DOJ attorney rather than a bureaucrat at USCIS, and in a lot of those cases, the U.S. attorney or assistant U.S. attorney rolls over and doesn't want to fight us. So that may be a reason we want to go to federal district court under the APA as opposed to an administrative appeal. We also look at, will district court be a more favorable venue? Is there a long line of recent AAO decisions denying the same kind of issue at the AAO, and it doesn't look like they're going to budge? If so, perhaps we've got a good argument we could take to federal court, and perhaps they'd be more open to our arguments. Client also might want to decide if it makes sense to be more aggressive or less aggressive. Going to federal court, you're suing the government, and so there are some risks there. But also, sometimes clients want to make a statement or make it clear that they're taking their case seriously and they want to be heard by a federal court that actually recognizes due process. And then the last reason, go ahead, Melissa.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say the last thing that we think about when we go to APA cases is this something the agency can't fix on its own? So sometimes the agency is bound by a bad regulation, a regulation that's ultra virus or doesn't track with the statute. Sometimes the agency is bound by a president that is directing it on what to do. If it's something the agency isn't going to be able to fix on its own, then filing an administrative appeal does nothing, whereas a federal court could tell the agency to reinterpret the law or do what the statute says.
Thank you. So how do you know where to file an APA claim? What particular district court do you go to, or do you have a choice?
You have a choice. Venue is governed by the federal rules. So before you decide to go to federal court, it's really important to understand the federal rules of civil procedure. Normally, the venue is where the applicant lives or where the decision was made, or Washington, D.C. Sometimes we decide we want to file where the applicant lives because that venue is especially kind to immigrants. Sometimes we don't want to file there for the same reason, that they're not kind to immigrants. Sometimes timing matters. There are certain courts that are much faster. The Eastern District of Virginia is an example. They call it the rocket docket for a reason. So if you have the ability to take your case to one of those venues, you may prefer to go where you're going to get your case decided faster than in another court.
And any practice pointers for our listeners on APA claims?
So I think that my number one practice pointer is to try to negotiate with the USCIS counsel first, especially if you have a relationship or want to develop a relationship with them over your long career. If the agency has made an obvious error that they can fix on their own, and if you can, take it to the USCIS counsel first and see if they can fix it, you've saved your client a docketing fee, you've saved them legal fees, and the USCIS counsel will appreciate it. Now, if they've got their dukes up and they're ready for a battle, then of course you're not going to be able to negotiate, but I always try that first. I think the second practice pointer is to be ready to take it to a final conclusion. Be ready. If they're going to file an answer and come back, try to defend the agency's decision, be ready to ask for discovery. Be ready to file a motion for summary judgment, be ready to take it to a conclusion. If you're willing to file a lawsuit, you gotta finish it up. And don't assume that the government will settle. I think, you know, a lot of these APA cases, the government, like I said, when you get to a U.S. attorney, they do roll over, but they don't always. And sometimes these are issues that they take seriously and they want to defend in federal court. So don't assume and don't tell your client that the government is going to settle, because they don't always. And then I'll say it again, know the federal rules, especially the rules for deadlines and how to serve the party you just sued, because they take it very seriously in federal court, and you can get your case dismissed and perhaps without the ability to refile it.
Great. So in terms of filing and serving defendants in a federal court case, I just want to mention the counsel's practice advisory called Whom to Sue and Whom to Serve. It's been updated relatively recently, and I think there's really good information in there that we're not going to have time to cover today. So before the travel ban was enjoined, we thought that USCIS was going to suspend adjudication of all pending petitions and applications from the affected countries. And if that had happened, mandamus claims would have become very, very important. In fact, we made it a priority to update our mandamus practice advisory because we were pretty sure that a lot of people were going to need it quickly. And so that's up on our website. As I think Paul mentioned before, the elements of a mandamus claim are that a plaintiff has a clear right to the relief that's requested. The defendant must have a clear duty to perform the act in question, and there can be no other adequate remedy available. As Paul mentioned earlier, there's always a chance that the court may compel the government to take action, but the action isn't what you were hoping for. So, you know, your client needs to be aware of that before you file. And it's important to emphasize that the court doesn't have authority to compel the agency to exercise its discretion in a particular manner, or, of course, to grant the relief that the plaintiff seeks from the agency. So all you can do is get the case moving again with a mandamus claim, nothing more, nothing less. In terms of where to file a mandamus action, we're looking at the same venue provision that Matthew just mentioned, 28 U.S.C. 1391E. And unless it's otherwise specified in a particular statute, the action can be filed in the judicial district in which the defendant resides, in which a substantial part of the events or omissions giving rise to the claim occurred, or, as Matthew said, in which the plaintiff resides. And I would just reiterate what Matthew said, that oftentimes the government does roll over. We had a lot of success many years ago in the naturalization context when lots of cases were bogged down with security checks and people would file mandamuses and all of a sudden the security check would clear and people didn't have to go forward with the litigation. But you've got to be ready to litigate if necessary and to go the full nine yards. We can't emphasize that enough. So I'll stop there unless either of my co-panelists has anything to add on mandamus.
No, that's great.
Okay. Super. So let's move on to costs. Filing a federal lawsuit has its own risks and benefits and costs. Matthew, can you tell us about some of these costs that people should be sure to apprise their client of before moving forward?
Sure. The docketing fee is real simple. It's $400 for a new civil case. In habeas, it's supposed to be $5, but I'm finding it when I file them online, I often end up having to pay the $400. There's not a good mechanism with our local court to pay the $5. But, and then aside from docketing fees, you're going to pay a process server if you're having the defendant served in person or by courier. If your client is poor and can meet the standards for informa pauperis, you can file a motion for leave to proceed informa pauperis, which means they don't have to pay their docketing fee. And I would point out that really varies by court. Some courts are a lot more liberal than others about granting informa pauperis. I think it's important to keep in mind you may go through discovery, even if you don't plan to. I'm litigating a case in Western District of Missouri about an APA or about an Adam Walsh Act challenge that we just went to depose assistant director of the Vermont Service Center in Vermont. Government decided they wanted to take a deposition, and we agreed. It actually helped us. But, you know, you have to anticipate you may end up doing some discovery. You may end up having to take a deposition, although in almost all APA cases, you don't get discovery. You're litigating based on what the record already is.
I think,
go ahead.
Matthew was right. The habeas does cost $5. I would be careful about doing a motion for informal pauper. In some cases, I've heard that when you do one, they will sometimes look at the merits of your case in a quicker fashion, and they might be more likely to dismiss it. Because in deciding the motion for informal pauper, they'll decide they may look at your case and be more quick to dismiss it.
Thanks. And the other side of costs is that sometimes when you are successful in litigating your case, you can apply for attorney's fees and costs under the Equal Access to Justice Act. 28 U.S.C. 2412 Section D authorizes payment by the government of attorney's fees and costs for successful litigation in the federal courts, and that can include petitions for review, mandamus, APA suits, and immigration-related habeas petitions. The award can cover time that you spend litigating the case as well as time spent litigating and preparing the request for fees. And any fees that your client has paid you, to retain your services are irrelevant to recovering the fees, although presumably you would have an arrangement with your client if you got fees at the end to reimburse them for some of what they had paid. Matthew or Paul, do you want to chime in on the statutory requirements for a fee petition?
Sure, I can take it. So I love EJA, not only because, you know, it's nice to get paid and get your client's fees back, but you can also use this to negotiate with the government when you're trying to settle a case. The statutory requirements are you have to file within 30 days of the day that the decision becomes final. In federal appeals courts, there's the issuance of the mandate, and that is tricky about when the case actually becomes final. But, you know, figure out when your decision becomes final, and then you have to file within 30 days. You have to be the prevailing party, so you have to have won. The Supreme Court has said there's no catalyst theory in EJA cases, although there is in other fee statutes like FOIA. There's not in the EJA, so you have to have won. You can't have just settled the case and caused the government to do what you wanted them to do. You have to get a decision that says you're the winner. And then the government's position can't have been substantially unjustified, and that includes their pre-litigation position, the position that they took that led you to take them to court. Those are your basic requirements. There's also an income requirement. I believe it's $1 million. Melissa might be able to correct me. My clients never meet it, so.
It's actually $2 million for an individual at the time the lawsuit was filed and $7 million for a corporation. The corporation can't have more than 500 employees at the time the lawsuit was filed, and a nonprofit only has to show that it similarly did not have more than 500 employees at the time the lawsuit was filed.
Well, there you go. That doesn't describe my clients. So,
ours either.
And then you can always ask for enhanced fees. The fee amount is set by statute, and I think it's $125. Most courts will at least adjust that for inflation because that number was set in the 80s. So inflation right now puts it at about $191 an hour. It might be $192 this year.
Yeah, I would also add that oftentimes in immigration-related federal court cases, you can get affidavits from, you know, people who are respected in the field, and there are even some immigration fee experts who will provide affidavits saying that you should get more than the standard rate because of the complexity and technicality of immigration law. In terms of doing a fee petition, it's really critical to keep very detailed time records that itemize exactly how much time you spend. We do it in sixth of an hour, so every 6 minutes is 6.1. And you want to be as specific as possible about the task that you're accomplishing, although you don't have to reveal any privileged information. So that's a fine balance to achieve. You want to keep these records on a daily basis, do them contemporaneously because it's really hard to catch up and recreate your time if you haven't done them at the time that you do the work. And just want to emphasize that only the work done in the federal court piece of the case is payable under the Equal Access to Justice Act. In terms of the time frame, Matthew mentioned that you've got to do it within 30 days or file a fee petition within 30 days of a final decision. We recently did a fee petition in a FOIA case, which is not under EJIA. It's under the FOIA statute. And we actually thought that we were close to achieving a negotiated settlement once the court had ruled. And so we didn't actually file a fee petition. And we were going back and forth with the government, and everything seemed fine until the point came where we got an email from the government telling us that we'd missed the deadline, and so they weren't going to negotiate anymore because we didn't file our fee petition. The judge didn't like that at all. We very quickly filed a fee petition and a motion to extend the time for filing the petition, given that we had been negotiating, and the judge granted it very quickly, in fact. So we did get our fees in that case. Any other comments on fees for our listeners? And I'll note as well that there is a practice advisory on our website about recovering fees under EJIA.
No, yeah, I've never been lucky enough to pull that up.
Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry to talk over you, Paul. One more thing is it's really important to put EJIA into your engagement letter because I think it's helpful to have the client agree to assign the EJIA award to you. There's a Supreme Court decision that talks about what to do with an EJIA award if your client owes the government money, and the answer is the government gets the EJIA award. So there are ways to avoid that by having them assign the EJIA award to you and make sure that in advance that you and your client know where's that EJIA award going to go and what's it going to cover if we end up getting fees.
Thank you. So I think that brings us just about to the end of our time. Do either of you have any final thoughts you'd like to offer to our listeners?
I just think that federal litigation is very rewarding, and that a lot of times as an immigration practitioner, we're very frustrated by the government's inability to act or to do anything at all. And by going into federal court, I've been able to accomplish results in a much shorter period of time than I would have with USCIS or with EOIR or with ICE. And so I would encourage people out there who are listening to devote the time that's necessary to learn how to do these things properly.
And can I add one more thing, Melissa?
Sure.
It's also important to know when the court does not have jurisdiction to hear this case. And some cases are outlined in 8 U.S.C. 1252. If the court doesn't have jurisdiction, don't file a federal lawsuit. Your client will be very upset with you when it gets dismissed for lack of jurisdiction. A good example is discretionary denials of Form I-485 application for adjustment of status. There are exceptions, cases we can take to federal court, but if you're just straight up appealing the denial as a matter of discretion, you're gonna be upset when you get to federal court and the court dismisses your case.
Thank you. That is a really important caveat, and I'll flag our practice advisory on how to circumvent the jurisdictional bars in certain circumstances. But there are many where you can't, so that's important to be aware of. So I think that concludes our podcast for today. Thank you both, and please feel free to follow up with any of us if you have questions after listening to this recording.